My name is Ben Whitehouse. I'm the literature coordinator for this year's festival. And it really warms me to see that there's so many people turned out for such an interesting talk. Andrew Tate is a lecturer at Lancaster University. And he's written very wisely and intelligently on postmodern literature and spirituality, particularly referencing the works of Douglas Copeland, which I'm very interested in. I hope you'll find this talk about sacred space and utopia interesting, and I'm going to hand you over to Andrew. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ben, and thanks very much to all of you for coming along. I'll try not to be an enormous disappointment. So today I'm going to be thinking about, as Ben says, sacred spaces in literature, the way in which literature imagines the sacred in relation to place and space. And in the second half of the talk, I'm going to be moving on to thinking about the notion of utopia, the perfect world, the perfect society. But I'm going to start with a brief consideration of this year's festival as a theme, standing in the long now. We're focusing on our relationship with different kinds of time, the slow but insistent tick of the clock, the acceleration of time in a world driven by new technologies, the haunting call of deep geological time, the long now, the dream of eternity. In this session, it might seem odd then that I'm moving away from thinking explicitly about time, about the temporal, to think primarily about the spatial. But I'll be thinking about the ways in which sacred spaces relate to time, relate to different kinds of time. So although I'm drawing on geography, on the language of space rather than that of time, I'm going to be thinking about both in terms of how we define that odd thing called the sacred. So for years and years, Greenbelt has started to think we shouldn't think of as separate from the rest of our lives, but in some ways integral to it. So it's a way of thinking about and rethinking about the everyday, the ordinary, as something special, something particular. What are sacred spaces? Well, we tend to think about, I suppose, places of pilgrimage, churches, holy sites blessed by their association with apparent miracles, for example. That's one very narrow definition, in one sense, of a sacred space. And some of the writers that I'm going to look at today are thinking about spaces that we wouldn't associate ordinarily with those kind of traditional definitions of holiness, of the sacred. Christians tend to think of spaces we no longer have any access to, spaces like the Garden of Eden, of the original paradise from which we're exiled, or of the New Jerusalem, of heaven, of the heavenly city to come. Sacred spaces we can only encounter imaginatively through prayer, through contemplation, through vision, and through literature. We might think in terms of literature offering a sacred space as a kind of place that we can easily turn to in the popular imagination, something like Middle Earth in Tolkien, or Narnia in C.S. Lewis, famous notions of special set apart different kinds of category of sacred space. But literature often finds other ways, ways of defamiliarizing our perception of the sacred and of space, of our relationship with it. And I want to start with one of the great romantic writers, one of the great Lake writers, William Wordsworth. Wordsworth has a kind of unfashionable reputation today, I think. He's a lot less attractive and appealing than somebody mad, bad and dangerous to know like Byron. He's a lot more conservative in many ways, certainly by reputation. But actually, he's the great poet that the 19th century had to come to terms with. And the poem that I'm going to look at today, or the beginning of the poem, is Tintern Abbey. This is the poem that poets like Tennyson and Matthew Arnold later on in the century, whenever they were writing about nature and reflecting on nature, Tintern Abbey was the kind of benchmark for thinking about it, particularly in relation to nature, to the natural landscape. It was published as part of Lyrical Ballads in 1798, a truly revolutionary work of literature, for the fact that it took on what Wordsworth called the language of men. It might seem rather archaic to us today, but it took on ordinary, everyday images, motifs, and languages, and did something interesting with them. It was co-authored famously with Coleridge, and Coleridge's Rime of the Ancient Mariner is included in that volume. Tintern Abbey itself inscribes a new sense of place that blurred the distinction between the everyday and the mystical, investing landscape with a vivid sense of memory. I'm now going to ask my reader, Simon Jones, to read the opening of this poem for us. Thanks, Simon.
Five years have passed, five summers with a length of five long winters. And again I hear these waters, rolling from their mountain springs with a sweet inland murmur. Once again do I behold these steep and lofty cliffs, which on a secluded scene impress thoughts of more deep seclusion and connect the landscape with the quiet of the sky. The day has come when I again repose here, under this dark sycamore, and view these plots of cottage ground, these orchard tufts, which, at this season, with their unripe fruits, among the woods and copses, lose themselves, nor, with their green and simple hue, disturb the wild green landscape. Once again, I see these hedgerows, hardly hedgerows, little lines of sportive wood run wild, these pastoral farms green to the very door, and wreaths of smoke sent up, in silence, from among the trees with some uncertain notice, as might seem of vagrant dwellers in the houseless woods, or of some hermit's cave, where by his fire the hermit sits alone. Though absent long, these forms of beauty have not been to me as is a landscape to a blind man's eye, but oft, in lonely rooms, amid the din of towns and cities, I have owed to them, in hours of weariness, sensations sweet, felt in the blood, and felt along the heart, and passing even into my purer mind, with tranquil restoration, feelings too of unremembered pleasure, such perhaps as may have had no trivial influence on that best portion of a good man's life, his little, nameless, unremembered acts of kindness and of love. Nor less, I trust, to them I may have owed another gift of aspect more sublime, that blessed mood in which the burthen of the mystery, in which the heavy and the weary weight of all this unintelligible world is lightened.
I don't know if it's because I'm now old, but I find those lines astonishingly beautiful. Not everybody in the 19th century necessarily appreciated Wordsworth. He was accused famously by John Keats, one of the next generation of romantic writers, of something called the egotistical sublime, that he invested himself so heavily in everything that he saw, his only subject was himself. Actually, I think it's much more problematic and interesting than that. Let's think simply about the title. Lines written a few miles above Tintern Abbey on revisiting the banks of the Wye during a tour, July 13th, 1798. It's explicitly invested in both place and space and time. July 13th, 1798. It has that quality of a journal entry, of recording what Wordsworth calls powerful feeling, recollected in tranquility. A theologian called Philip Sheldrake, who wrote a book that I'd really recommend to you called Spaces for the Sacred, says this: place is space that has the capacity to be remembered and to evoke what is most precious. Perhaps some of your memories of Greenbelt operate in that kind of way. It no longer is simply a blank space, but it one that has the capacity to be remembered and to evoke what is most precious. Wordsworth's poem is sometimes read simply as a work of pantheism, that is, nature worship. But I think the poem invokes a much more complex sense of the relationship between humanity, between story and landscape. The poet cannot easily separate himself from the landscape he's describing, a ruined abbey, a reminder of the great faith of the past. I'm going to move now into the 20th century and a vivid contrast with this strong sense of precious space, of landscape invested with memory. And this is into a term coined by a French anthropologist called Marc Auger. It really helps if you're going to be an anthropologist or a philosopher to be French. Marc Auger sounds much, much better, doesn't it, than, you know, Mark Smith or whatever. It does give him a certain kind of credibility straight away. Now, Auger has thought in detail about the way in which contemporary space tends to be non-place. He lists places like supermarkets, like airport lounges, and consumer-driven spaces, spaces that aren't creative, spaces that are utterly homogenous in one way or another, spaces in which our behaviour is dictated, organised and so on. A shopping mall would be an example of that. Motivated spaces, spaces designed to fleece you of money effectively and that are utterly transient. It's hard to imagine somebody writing a poem like Tintin Abbey about a shopping mall in the same kind of way. Perhaps. There's a contemporary novelist who Benjamin mentioned, who I've written a bit about, called Douglas Copeland. And his work very much addresses that kind of anxiety about consumer culture in a number of different ways. In his book, a non-fiction book, Souvenir of Canada, one of his first really explicit, detailed readings of national identity, it begins with an aerial vision of the country's unpopulated, wild northern lands. So he starts by looking from a plane at this landscape. "I fly more than most people," he says. "I've flown across Canada a conservative total of 55 times, most likely more. There's just all of this land down there, blank and essentially uninhabited. No roads or power lines. Will these vast refrigerated stones someday harbour modern cities and societies? Corner mulls with a lens crafters and a Baskin Robbins on a Baffin Island. What does it mean for Canadians that we own these huge rocks if there's not really much we can do on them?" So gazing at this enigmatic landscape, the writer lists places that, apart from the act of naming, appear to be untainted by human intervention. Hudson Bay and Ungava Peninsula, Ellesmere Island, Baffin Island. So this interesting perspective on space that hasn't been corrupted, hasn't been turned simply into yet another consumer operation. Air travel in this instance might revise our familiar perception of the world. There's this sudden kind of illusion of a godlike perception of the world. Panoramic visions such as this are fleeting, but for the narrator and many other nomadic privileged citizens, because you do need a kind of privilege to get that kind of perspective, the frequent repetition of flight can alter deep-rooted beliefs about self, society, and indeed, nation. Despite Copeland's anxieties about the creeping homogenisation, the idea that space is increasingly the same, you go to any high street in this country and they'll have identical shops, for example, it's hard to know where you are in some senses, even though you know you're kind of everywhere and nowhere at the same time. Copeland's work is also interested in ways in which the everyday can become sacred, can become vividly invested with memory in a similar kind of way to that great poem by Wordsworth. In fact, there's a chapter in his first novel, Generation X, published 18 years ago, 1991. And the chapter investigates the significance of a Christian festival celebrated by a family without religious beliefs. Now, the narrator of this story returns home. Nobody's really interested in celebrating Christmas. Nobody really has any kind of sense of spiritual memory, if you like. And unbeknownst to them, when they're out and about doing their own thing, he creates this festival of light, surrounds the house with thousands of candles bought from a supermarket, and he creates this kind of image of holiness. As the people enter the room, this is what he says: "The three of them enter the room, speechless, turning in slow circles, seeing the normally dreary living room covered with a molten living cake icing of white fire, all surfaces devoured in flame, a dazzling fleeting empire of ideal light. All of us are instantaneously disembodied from the vulgarities of gravity. We enter a realm in which all bodies can perform acrobatics like an astronaut in orbit. This light is also making the eyes of my family burn, if only momentarily, with the possibilities of existence in our time. So the suburban, the bland, the ordinary, the unmemoried becomes a place of story, of possibility. Think about the way in that passage that scientific language and religious or spiritual language comes together, and it doesn't clash. It creates something new. It synthesizes it in a very interesting and distinctive way. We're going to move back now from the 20th century, the late 20th century, into the middle of the 19th century, to one of Wordsworth's contemporaries, a writer really of the American Romantic movement. There's a kind of equivalent movement in America to the one that's going on in Britain, of writers who are much more interested in the spiritual, in the experience of life that is much more intuitive, that is less concerned with what Wordsworth would have called getting and spending, with that kind of materialist life. This is a figure called Henry David Thoreau. He was known as a transcendentalist. It's a term that was used as a kind of a term of opprobrium, a critique at the time. It suggested these people were caught up with airy-fairy spiritual ideas. And actually, he would have been regarded as something of a crank. He was a contemporary of writers like Nathaniel Hawthorne and Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman. Anyway, in 1845, he began a two-year experiment of living self-sufficiently. On his own, he built a little shed at Walden Pond near Concord, Massachusetts. And for about 2 years, he lived on his own. It must be said he did occasionally go back and, you know, get people to wash his socks and so on. More interestingly than the experiment, in a sense, was the story he wrote about it. The long narrative, not a novel, piece of prose that explores his own experience. And he says this about the reason he went. "I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front the essential facts of life and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived." So this, in many ways, was a kind of early form of withdrawal from consumer culture. By the 1840s, America was an increasingly confident country that was regarded as on the verge of a great industrial breakthrough that was one of the world's first great democracies. But writers like Thoreau and his friend Emerson started to see much darker currents in their country. Thoreau was one of the first writers from the North to explicitly be against slavery and segregation. He was an abolitionist at a time when most of his fellow white liberal writers really were silent on these kind of issues. Anyway, at this time he withdrew briefly, and I'm going to ask Simon again to read a passage from a chapter called Solitude.
"This is a delicious evening, when the whole body is one sense and imbibes delight through every pore. I go and come with a strange liberty in nature, a part of herself. As I walk along the stony shore of the pond in my shirt sleeves, though it is cool as well as cloudy and windy, and I see nothing special to attract me, all the elements are unusually congenial to me. The bullfrogs trump to usher in the night, and the note of the whippoorwill is borne on the rippling wind from over the water. Sympathy with the fluttering alder and poplar leaves almost takes away my breath, yet, like the lake, my serenity is rippled but not ruffled. These small waves, raised by the evening wind, are as remote from storm as the smooth reflecting surface. Though it is now dark, the wind still blows and roars in the wood, the waves still dash, and some creatures lull the rest with their notes. The repose is never complete. The wildest animals do not repose, but seek their prey now. The fox and skunk and rabbit now roam the fields and woods without fear. They are nature's watchmen, links which connect the days of animated life. I have my horizon bounded by woods all to myself, a distant view of the railroad where it touches the pond on the one hand and of the fence which skirts the woodland road on the other. But for the most part, it is as solitary where I live as on the prairies. It is as much Asia or Africa as New England. I have, as it were, my own sun and moon and stars and a little world all to myself. At night, there was never a traveller passed my house or knocked at my door more than if I were the first or last man. Yet I experienced sometimes that the most sweet and tender, the most innocent and encouraging society may be found in any natural object, even for the poor misanthrope and most melancholy man. There can be no very black melancholy to him who lives in the midst of nature and has his senses still. There was never yet such a storm, but it was aeolian music to a healthy and innocent ear. Nothing can rightly compel a simple and brave man to a vulgar sadness. While I enjoy the friendship of the seasons, I trust that nothing can make life a burden to me.
So that's either the kind of passage that's going to inspire you to greater efforts to protect the environment, or you're going to want to go straight to McDonald's and The Gap and HMV. Thoreau, I think, could be accused of simply withdrawing from society, of doing something incredibly self-indulgent, of ignoring the kind of political struggles that he recognised. But in a sense, the fact that he came back and wrote this narrative and encouraged his fellow Americans to live much more simple lives, or to think about the kind of consumer culture that was beginning to take root, a kind of early nascent capitalist culture, it can be suggested that actually this is a work of confrontation. Actually, Thoreau is responsible for a term that's passed into contemporary thought, the idea of civil disobedience, the idea of peaceful protest. Really, that starts in America with Thoreau. So he's somebody who is very much invested in landscape, preserving landscape. Interestingly, he doesn't necessarily use the same kind of religious vocabulary that many of his contemporaries were using. But what he does is he refers to lots and lots of different world religions in his texts. Not in a way that today we define necessarily as New Age, but the fact that he found common ground in terms of the way in which stewardship should occur between different religious traditions. And that's significant. He might also be accused of a kind of utopian thinking, the kind of term that gets trotted out quite regularly by commentators and indeed by some politicians today, the idea that you're trying to build an impossible, perfect society. And that's what I'm going to move on to in the second part of my talk, this term utopia. It goes back to the 16th century and was coined by Sir Thomas More. He wrote a narrative called Utopia, a vision of the perfect society, a world in which freedom is the norm, in which religious tolerance is extended to all, in which education is free for both men and women. We're not really there yet, are we? Utopia as a term plays on a Greek piece of terminology, meaning good or perfect place, and also no place. It can literally be translated as nowhere. And that's part of the problem with it. The critic Terry Eagleton says that utopias are the most self-undermining of literary forms, that they always have the seeds of their own destruction, the seeds certainly of their own impossibility. At their best, they're a way of challenging our current kind of complacency, if you like, about injustice, offering a vision of the world as it might be, as we might achieve it. But I think they are problematic in all sorts of ways as well. Later visions of utopia, frequently without any kind of religion or what we define as spirituality, without worship, without work. I'm going to turn now to a text written by William Morris, written in 1890 called News from Nowhere. Some of you have encountered a fictional version of Morris on the rather racy BBC series about the Pre-Raphaelites at the moment, in which he's presented as a kind of bumbling fool, which is very, very unfair to Morris, I think. I'll get down off my hobby horse about BBC dramas now. I rather enjoyed it in other respects. But Morris, I think, was unfairly kind of maligned there. In his text, News from Nowhere, another kind of synonym from Utopia, for Utopia, a man called William, known as William Guest, wakes up in the distant future London. He spent a night before carousing and arguing with his friends in the London Socialist League, as I imagine a number of you did before you arrived at Greenbelt. He wakes up to discover that the Socialist Republic, some years hence, 100 years or so hence, has finally taken place. It's a world free from hierarchies, no institutions such as Parliament. Parliament's now a place for storing dung. I guess, actually, if you tried to do that at a certain point this year, people would have been quite up for it, the kind of tabloid headlines that were being written. Prisons no longer exist anymore. There are no schools. There's no industrial technology. It either sounds like heaven or hell, I guess. A few of you are looking at your iPhones at this stage thinking, good Lord, that sounds appalling. There's a strong emphasis on craftsmanship, on the individual as somebody who is creative enough to produce something new and dynamic. And it's really a challenge. It's an inverse vision of the 19th century. As Guest returns to his own world, it's with a refreshed perspective that a struggle is necessary, that justice is possible. In some ways, it's a kind of displaced Christianity for Morris. He displaces it into a notion of socialist utopia, something that we don't have to wait for heaven to attain. And it is very significant that there's no kind of religious dimension explicitly to this. A number of Wells's contemporaries were more sceptical. H.G. Wells, in A Modern Utopia, says that the big problem with utopias, as presented by people like Morris, was that they were static, whereas utopia should be kinetic. Rather than still and ordered and finalised, utopia, to be such, always has to be characterised by movement, by dynamism, if you like. And I think actually that's much closer to a vision of Christian eschatology, of the apocalyptic, as it were, of revelation. We're interested in ways in which the world needs to continually change, continually be transformed and transfigured. And I'm going to turn now to a text by H.G. Wells called The Time Traveller, published in 1895. It's not, strictly speaking, a utopian text, but it's a text about utopia and dystopia, the reverse, the nightmare image of it. It's one of his scientific romances. If you've not read it, I really strongly recommend that you do. It's a really good, fun read. Still very fresh, despite its kind of Edwardian qualities as well. Edwardian, late Victorian. When he arrives in the future, this future that's 800,000 years hence, but happily he's aware that he's still in Greenwich and Richmond and so on. He doesn't have to travel very far in space, even if he does so in time. Initially, he thinks he's in a kind of utopia. He encounters these very peaceful people called the Eloi. They live in a harmonious relationship with nature. And it's interesting that the language he uses is explicitly that of the Garden of Eden. It's this lush, untroubled paradise, or so he thinks. Eventually, the novella becomes a much darker allegory of class relations in the 19th century. It turns out that the aristocratic Eloi, decadent and unintelligent, very much representative of the leisured classes in the late 19th century, are preyed on by the spider-like Morlocks. I always had a soft spot for them, who dwell in the underworld, and they come out at night and eat the Eloi. I'm not defending cannibalism in that sense, but it's an interesting inversion of what was going on in the late 19th century. The fact that Wells could look at his world and see a deeply dystopian present, a deeply nightmarish present, in which the aristocrats were really feeding on the poor in a number of different ways. And actually he takes that to its logical extreme, to think, well, actually, eventually, the poor, who are learning all sorts of skills, the Morlocks in the future are industrialised, they can work with technology, and they rise up. Is it a revolutionary text? Well, in some ways, it actually might be a kind of a work of conservative anxiety, of paranoia, if you like, a warning, rather than a demand for revolution, a kind of reformist text. Treat these people well, because otherwise, eventually, their ancestors will eat yours. So it's a kind of utopian text that plays on notions of dystopia. We then come into the 20th century to texts like George Orwell's 1984. I'm not sure that it's possible to say anything interesting about 1984, living in the kind of world that we live in, a world in which notions of, Big Brother and so on are everywhere and on our television. And it was a great utopian moment this week when that was announced that was going to be cancelled from next year. I could briefly believe we were living in utopia once again. We then get much odder texts, like Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. Its title, a quotation, an ironic quotation from Shakespeare, "O Brave New World," from The Tempest, written, believe it or not, in 1932. A really fresh, odd, strange, dystopian text that was written actually as a critique of utopian texts, of a text that believe humanity could easily achieve the perfect world. We get this sterile, bland, joyless, inauthentic world in which reproduction is utterly controlled by science, by a centralised technological society. This perfect world, which is free from competition, the ordinary mess of human life, from art, officially from desire — desire is controlled by drugs — is very much a critique of the whole utopian project, the idea that you can easily achieve a perfect world, a perfect society. In the 1980s, we get a work of speculative fiction in Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, a great staple of the A-level syllabus now, I think. And really an allegory of the way in which women are treated in the West. Very much an examination by a Canadian novelist of US policy, I think, in particular. So we enter a world again where reproduction is controlled. It's a post-apocalyptic world, though we're not told specifically of the environmental disaster that has taken place. But it contains seeds within it for ways of subverting that kind of world. Visions of the future tend very much to be conditioned by the world in which they're produced. They are always political. There's no real notion of science fiction or fantasy that doesn't, in one way or another, engage with the present, either in a conservative way to kind of back up the status quo, or subtly to subvert it. There's nothing particularly subtle about The Handmaid's Tale, but it does demand a kind of response from us, particularly in terms of its critique of gender relations at that time. We also get stuff like Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick, published in 1968. So a long time before the film in 1982. Don't worry, I'm not going to do a long talk now about whether Harrison Ford is really a robot. We can have that chat later on if you like. But another kind of post-apocalyptic future that, again, is a critique of a technological utopia, the idea that the perfect world can be achieved with technology. There's a deep distrust in that narrative of the idea of human perfection. In fact, I think narratives like that and The Handmaid's Tale always have a notion that humanity is in one way or another fallen, even if it doesn't use an explicit Christian vocabulary to do that. A more recent text, not strictly dystopian, but a ruined world narrative, is Cormac McCarthy's The Road. I'm just going to do a little litmus test here. I've done it with one or two other texts in the past. How many of you have read The Road by Cormac McCarthy? That's the fair smattering. That's pretty good. A few of you can pretend now to have read it if you like. But I mean, it's a novel you'd read very, very quickly. It's a compelling, rather bleak and rather beautiful story. A father-son story that uses this notion of an irreversibly ruined world. There's no easy redemption here. There's no get out in this landscape. There's no way of putting things back. It exists as a warning in some senses, but it also has a strong sense of beauty in the negative. what you realise throughout is that you're missing nature, because nature simply isn't available as a way of writing, even metaphorically. We think back to Tintin Abbey and the way in which Wordsworth is able to explore his own emotion in response to landscape. Landscape has simply disappeared into a pile of ash and into behaviour that's kind of atavistic. The only other human beings they meet, generally speaking, on this road trip are ruined. Their hope is destroyed. But the hope shared between father and son, and there is that kind of theological resonance to the relation between father and son, is never quite ruined. And it's not ordinary humanist hope. It's not actually at heart we're really great. It has to look out of itself. The son never fails to look for God. At the end of the story, he's still looking for God. I won't ruin it for you, but I certainly recommend you read it before you get to the movie, which is coming out later this year. And actually, the movie looks very good. Doesn't look like a date movie, certainly not a first date movie. A little bleak in that sense. So utopia, is that something that Christians can easily hold on to, that actually what we're working for is simply an idealised world? I think if we think of the idea of utopia as something fixed, static, as H.G. Wells said, we're always going to run into troubles, into kind of totalitarian worldviews, without difference, without desire, without notions of our own specific identity. But the notion of the perfect society is something we have to struggle for, certainly in relation to the just. But it has a lot to do with our own perception of how we see the everyday, the here and now. And I'm going to end with a text that looks at the world with defamiliarized eyes. If utopia ultimately disappoints, it might be because we anticipate or somehow intuit a capacity for sin. We know that human beings, however much better they might become, do fail, will continue to fail. Maybe, as Beckett says, we can fail better. But ordinary human failure is always going to be part of our story. Utopian or dystopian literature can, however, challenge us to be better stewards of creation, to view the landscape, the environment, food and fuel with a more just eye. And I'm going to end now, as I say, with not a dystopian text, but a text that I think can renew our perspective on creation. Simon's going to read it, and then I'm going to have a few concluding comments. And it's Gerard Manley Hopkins' God's Grandeur.
The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shock foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights of the black west went, oh, morning at the brown brink eastward springs. Because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with, bright wings.
Thank you, Simon. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. We get that sense of the transcendence and simultaneously the immanence of God. God visible in his work, in his creation. Space and the sacred are brought together in the specifics of the everyday. It's not about a spirituality or a sense of the sacred that is elsewhere. It's something created, but it's present, as well as somehow mysteriously beyond us. So we get both this sense of transcendence, the awe of God. After all, Hopkins was writing as a Jesuit poet, somebody in that tradition, somebody with a very strong sense of the transcendence of God, God as holy other, but also of immanence, of God as present, as participating in his creation. We get a strong awareness here of the human capacity for appreciation and for destruction. The poem, in a sense, is a call for what we might say deceleration, for slowing down, for observing the world. The act of writing the poem, of observing itself, is an act of withdrawal from the everyday hurly-burly, if you like, from getting and spending. So it calls the poet and the reader into a different relationship with space and with time. It also has this strong sense of the possibility of environmental damage. In that sense, without being reductive, it is one of the great early green poems. I'm not sure what Hopkins would make of that. Hopkins, incidentally, is always a salutary figure for me, because I understand that when he died, he was stressed out after marking a lot of undergraduate essays. So I kind of, I always bear that in mind. We get a challenge to casual perception. The idea that the sacred is elsewhere is shaken up, defamiliarised, transfigured, remade. Okay, thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions if anybody wants to ask any. Yeah, that'd be good, yeah.
There's somebody towards the front.
Thanks very much for speaking. I was just wondering whether you could recommend an anti-road, whether there's a book that is not pessimistic about the future, but does talk about important stuff like the environment and familial relationships and that kind of thing.
Well, I'd recommend two things, and unfortunately, and rather stereotypically, I'm going to recommend two things by Douglas Copeland. So I really apologise for that if you can't abide Copeland. Girlfriend in a Coma, in some ways, is the hopeful account, if you like, even though we get a sense of ruin, we also get a sense of possibility. Copeland's new novel, Generation A, is set in a not distant future, about 20 years hence. It's just coming out this weekend. And again, it emphasises the importance of familial relations, even though they're not the kind of familial relations one might anticipate. And also, I mean, so it's set in a future in which bees have disappeared. We finally got rid of bees, and they suddenly reappear and sting these five people. And it's about the stories of how these five people come together. So it's not as bleak, I have to say. There are a couple of other novels. There's The Pest House by Jim Crace. I'd strongly recommend that. A great novelist. Not quite as bleak as The Road. The Cahulan Army by... I feel really embarrassed because she's a Cumbrian novelist. Sarah Hall, in a moment. Yeah, Sarah Hall, who wrote Electric Michelangelo. So that's my little reading list. Okay, any other questions?
You say that in how space, sacred space, is different from other spaces, how that's kind of divine, how in a world where everything is homogenous, and kind of the super shopping mall world, that's not the case anymore. So do you think that human beings can threaten what is divine and what is sacred and destroy it, or could it not be because it's related to God?
I mean, I think that's a very good question. I mean, I think... don't get me wrong, I don't think you have to go to Tintern Abbey or the Lake District or a beautiful beach on the northeast to get in touch with God, and that you might not do that in a shopping mall. I mean, I think from an environmental perspective, and just for a sense of the kind of the sheer difference and diversity of human culture, human beings can threaten, you know, what is God given. But no, I mean, I think it's partly about our own perception and about our failure to look really at the world in all sorts of ways, imaginatively as well as physically, to kind of slow down and think about things. It's a slightly woolly answer in some ways, and I think we will regret the kind of damage we're inflicting on the world. You know, and I have little time for people who say, well, we're going to ruin the landscape by putting wind farms on them. I mean, let's not get started on that discussion. But the kind of sentimental notion of landscape as well, I think that's a problem too. So I think it's tricky.
The American author from the 19th century, was it Thoreau?
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about the other authors you mentioned, like Whitman and Emerson, and you mentioned that they talk about religious imagery, or they use religious imagery a lot. Could you just sort of point out the difference?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one, because Thoreau in some ways was much more optimistic about human behaviour, and human behaviour in America, as was Emerson, actually. They were both people who thought that America was a place for new men, new lands, new ideas, and so on. Both Melville, who wrote Moby Dick, and Hawthorne had a much darker view, which was much more bound up with notions of original sin, for example. So a text like The Scarlet Letter, which evokes very vividly space and place in its recreation of Puritan America of the 17th century, he thought, actually, we can't transcend human sin, original sin, in that sense. We can't get beyond it. So he had a very pessimistic view, really. He didn't believe in perfectibility in the same kind of way. Whitman actually is much closer to Thoreau. He has a much more kind of fleshly, kind of celebratory sense, very influenced by the Greek writers and so on, than the explicitly kind of Judeo-Christian tradition. I'd be happy to talk to you about that more if you want to know more. I can talk about it for quite a long time. So. Oh, there's a question there. Yeah. It's a brave man in shorts. I like that. It's impressive.
It's necessary. Thank you for a marvellous talk. And I'm struck by how utopias and dystopias and cacotopias appear not only in literature, but film, of course. And, you know, an example which comes to mind, which touches on all of what you were talking about, is Sean Penn's Into the Wild, which celebrates a character who, ironically, we would never want it to have appeared on screen. So my questions are, to what extent do you think utopias are undermined by their popular representation? And when does a utopia lose all imaginative hold on our emotions and our ambitions?
Oh, that's quite a difficult question. Ask me the ones about football. No, that's really good. I think, firstly, to answer the first part of your question, yeah. I think there is no utopia without their popular representation. Okay. So, I mean, they're undermined in the sense that we get an awareness of their impossibility. They tend to end by crumbling, or to realise or recognise the snake in the garden in different ways. Yeah. News from Nowhere ends with Guest. It's an odd kind of erotic ending. He's waiting to finally get together with this beautiful woman he's met, and then he wakes up. Mm. And there's a sense that the beautiful woman is also utopia. He's never going to quite meet her in that sense. From the perspective of film, we might say, well, commercially, they're driven by certain kinds of expectation that fiction often doesn't have to be, unless it's specifically designed in that kind of way. So it might pull its punches in various different ways. I mean, I think it's a fascinating and big question. I think utopias are far less popular today than dystopias. In some ways, we kind of like punishing ourselves, don't we? We like going and seeing the horror that we do in all sorts of different ways, not just in dystopian movies, Blade Runner, and lots of others, the fact that The Road is going to come out this year and it's being tipped for Oscars and so on. We like seeing ourselves at our worst. We like getting a scare, a shock, and so on. Utopias can be bland on the screen. Who wants to see people being nice to each other for 2 hours? If I was a bit sharper, I'd think of a really bad film and insert it there, but it doesn't come to mind. There's no drama, is there, without sin, in that sense, and utopias create the myth of a kind of sin-free world, if you like.
I'm thinking particularly the idea that a utopia in some sense creates an intimacy, whether between the character or the environment, the place, the memories they evoke.
Yes.
And how that is in effect robbed when it becomes shared too much in a way.
I'm going to do one little bit of French theory, mainly because I only know one little bit of French theory. And it's to use another term, and that's heterotopia, which is a term that was coined by Michel Foucault. So you do have to have a cool French name to be a theorist. And the idea of the heterotopia is the other space that somehow mirrors and kind of invert ordinary everyday expectation. And one approach is to see literature itself as the heterotopia. You know, it's the place in which we can challenge ourselves. Now, I don't want to say, you know, if you read good books, you will be a good person. the Nazis were very into literature, you know. It doesn't necessarily civilise in that way, but it can defamiliarise, it can challenge, it can invert things in that way. But anyway, that was a great question. Thank you. Time for one more, if anybody wants to ask a question. I'm very happy to have a go at answering it. One there, sorry. After, maybe.
Yeah, just to pick up on that last point, that art and literature is a way of often a way of looking at ordinary things in a new way and with, like, fresh eyes. And I really like the example you used from the Copeland book about all the candles, and taking a very ordinary space and making it special. I mean, would you say that that's kind of something that utopias are about, is trying to, when they apply to our ordinary world, but make us try and think about it in a new way or live our ordinary lives in a new way? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's a way of inverting things, of playing around with our expectations. I mean, there's an example of a short story by Martin Amis that isn't utopian. It's called Straight Fiction. And it's set in a world where almost everybody is gay. Straight people are in a tiny minority. And it's a very, very politicised, fun story. But it's a challenge to readers' expectations in that way. And yeah, I think absolutely, those kind of fictions, we can kind of illuminate and invert our world and rethink our prejudices, our assumptions, our unjust behaviour, our faithless behaviour, all of those kind of things. In new ways. And in one sense, I can't think any better way than the arts of doing that. And actually, in church, in different kinds of church spaces that we meet, we're having to continually defamiliarise our understandings of the everyday, simply because we get too close to things. We don't think about them closely enough. It's partly what the point of meeting is to do, I think. Again, great question. Thank you. So I think we have to finish up there. I'd be very happy to answer any questions anybody else might have after the session. But I'm really honoured that you all came. Thank you so much. Thank you.